Hey there, everybody. Welcome to This Show So Gay. I'm Ken. I know what you're thinking, loyal listeners. You hear my voice in a cold open before we even do the intro music. It means something went wrong and we're playing a repeat. But no, this actually is a new show this week. We have the fantastic Abe Sylvia, writer-director Abe Sylvia, who's going to be on in just a few. But yeah, something went wrong. Okay, something went wrong. A fellow radio dude said, you guys at This Show So Gay, you have to try this piece of recording equipment. It's going to make your telephone interview so much sharper. You're going to love this. Try it. So we said, of course, fellow radio dude, we'll try it. So we tried it. We tried it out on writer-director Abe Sylvia. Yeah, it didn't work very well. And the sound quality on this week's episode is so far off. And actually, if you pretend that we're in a vintage radio interview, like a talkie kind of thing, it's the coolest thing ever, but not what we were going for. So it sounds like Abe's on the phone, which he called in. Also sounds like I'm on the phone. Later on in the show, Jody and I will recap this week's news. So get past the sound issues, listen to this great interview, have a very gay week, and we'll see you next week when the sound will be back to normal.
Everybody, it is Wednesday, December 7th, 2011, and you are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm Ken. As always, you can drop us a line by sending us an email at ken@thisshowisogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com to learn about all the fun things happening with our gay little show. And of course, go to the Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have a jam-packed show for you this week, so we are ready to kick things off. Hey, first guest, are you ready to go?
Yeah.
All right, let me introduce you. Abe Sylvia began his career in entertainment as a Broadway performer, working with such directors as Mel Brooks, Jerry Mitchell, Jeff Calhoun, Jeremy Sams, and Tommy Toon. A graduate of UCLA's School of Theater, Film, and Television, Abe was the recipient of the Jack Nicholson Distinguished Director Award, the James Bridges Prize in Directing, and a finalist in the 2006 Chrysler Film Project. His short films have screened in over 100 international festivals. He recently made his directorial debut with a film he wrote called Dirty Girl, a coming-of-age road trip film set in the 1980s Oklahoma, and he was named just so recently to our favorite list of all the lists, the Out 100 Most Influential Folks on LGBT Culture in 2011. Abe Sylvia, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Oh, thanks for having me.
How are you?
I'm doing good.
We start, as we always start, with the Out 100. What was that experience like for you?
Oh, it was just a real honor. It came out of nowhere. I got an email and asking if it would be okay if they honor me. I'm like, yeah, it's fine. I'm so sorry, but my dogs are barking.
That's okay. We find that the appeal of This Show Is So Gay on the canine population is actually quite tremendous.
They're barking at my neighbor. Oh, it's so funny. I shut them away thinking that, I knew if they made noise.
We're not even going to edit them out, Abe. We like featuring them on our show.
Okay, well, my dog's names are Alice and Jennifer, just so that they're properly
pronounced. Spoken like a true director.
They would demand, I think. They want to know where their name appears in the billing block.
That's funny. So you got this call from Al Magazine or an email, and you naturally said yes.
Absolutely.
And then they did a really cool they always do very cool photos.
Yes, yeah. I think that all of the photos were based on famous images of the 20th century. And, once I saw the final collection, I was really blown away. I love the takeoff on the Patti Smith portrait.
Yeah.
That one just, blew my mind. Because they got the lighting so right. I mean, that's obviously where my head goes in terms of cinematography.
Indeed.
That Maple Thorpe takeoff was really fantastic. And, my photo was, I think, was a takeoff on a picture of Buster Keaton, I got to do that with my friend Josh Berman, who created Drop Dead Diva, and a really, really great guy.
Now, the important thing, did you get to go to the party?
I did go to the party, yes.
There were some people at the party.
There were a lot of people at the party. It was a real hoot. we had a great time and ran into a bunch of old friends and made new ones, and a really good time.
All right. Anyway, all right, so we got to go back a bit. We got to go back a bit to your career as a Broadway performer, because I'm very excited, because we don't often get people on Broadway on the show, because they're always touring.
On a show called This Is So Gay?
I know. You're breaking the mold. We get a lot of theater critics.
I've got some numbers for you.
You'll give me those after it could be for the show, too.
That's funny.
So you got your start as a Broadway performer. Give us some Abe Sylvia Broadway highlights.
Well, my first show, I was a junior in college, and I took the bus all night. And Tommy Toon was always my hero growing up because he was tall like me, and obviously I'm not as tall as him, but he was this tall dancer, and dancers I thought weren't supposed to be tall, and he was my hero. And so I took the bus all night to audition for his show called Busker Alley, and like in sort of true Broadway New York, lore way, I booked the show. I booked my first New York audition.
Look at that.
Yeah, it was really one of those, incredibly surreal moments. And so I went on the road with that, and it was a real experience. Jeff Calhoun directed it. Jerry Mitchell was the co-choreographer, and Tommy starred in it. And it was a real lesson. And the show, the show closed out of town. But it was such a great first showbiz experience because I got to work with my heroes, and I got to watch my heroes really grapple with a creative problem that the show wasn't working, and to see, to realize that show business isn't all, sort of flowers and daisies, and it's a lot of hard work, and even your heroes are going to struggle sometimes. It was a really, incredible lesson.
And did the family get to see you quite a bit on Broadway stages?
Oh, yeah. My parents and my sisters and old friends from high school. I toured a lot as well, and that show closed out of town, and then I had quit school to go do it. And then moved to New York just so that I could tell myself that it wasn't a fluke that I got this show. And a month later, I got the national tour of Joseph with Donny Osmond, and it went back to Boston, which is where I was in school. So I ended up going back and finishing my degree, in Boston while doing the show at night. And so that was all's well that ends well. And then moved to New York and got cast in Cats and did Cats for 2 years on Broadway. And then did the original company of Mel Brooks as the producers. And
Look at that.
That was the last show that I did in New York, and it was kind of a perfect swan song because the show just, it worked from the first read through, and Mel and Stroman are fantastic examples, and I reference Stroman a lot for her ability to organize a group around a creative thought, and how much of that is really organizational skill, and I just learned so much about directing from her that 75% of the battle is having a plan. Then I came to LA and I enrolled at UCLA, and 10 years later finally got to make my movie.
Look at that! It's patience, a little bit of patience. So we've actually had a number of Broadway critics on the show before, and a lot of them bemoan, decry that the state of Broadway is that you have to have a certain aesthetic in order to make it as a Broadway performer. Is that something that you experienced in your work on Broadway?
How do you mean a certain aesthetic, as a performer?
Very much that it didn't matter what kind of voice you had, you just had to have that kind of spelt 1950s, 1940s Broadway look to you, and that hasn't evolved much. And we've certainly seen a lot on Broadway that indicates that it has evolved. But that you have to be just kind of very archetype thin buff guy to make it as a Broadway performer.
I don't know. I think to play the thin buffed parts, you do.
Yes.
I knew plenty of character actors who had fine careers, that didn't fit that mold. The shows that I was in, I can't speak to what's happening right now. I've sort of fallen out of the loop. But if you didn't have the goods to turn it out 8 times a week. With your voice or with your abilities as a dancer, you weren't going to get the job. That was my experience. I mean, the people really were the cream of the crop.
Yeah.
And this having been doing plays through community theater and then working for the university level and then being on tours and then finally making it to Broadway, it's the same people who work a lot. I think Actors Equity has 98% unemployment.
Right.
But the 2% that work always work, and there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
That was kind of always my thinking. When I was doing producers, almost everybody in that show came from another show.
You know, that was not a show that was putting a bunch of unemployed people to work. It was like, oh, good, new show. We're going to move over there. So that was my experience.
Well, the other piece, and then we'll leave.
It isn't just physical.
It's not just physical, yeah. Well, the other piece, and then we'll leave Broadway behind for a bit, is that it can be seen also as kind of this inaccessible art form just because the ticket prices are so cost prohibitive.
That's really a shame. Yeah, I think that's an incredible shame. And, you know, it's funny, I had a very similar conversation with my manager the other day, and we were talking, you know, we actually met as undergrad theater majors together, and, you know, there's this whole sort of school of thought that any new musical or any new play has to be this, you know, sort of incredible addition to the great canon of great works. And it's like, well, you know, there's a lot of middle-brow stuff that's just fun and entertaining, and that has its place, too. And I think that there is something that's become so, you know, become so rarefied that something can't just be kind of a fun mediocrity and get by.
Right.
You know, we see that all the time in movies. You know, like, how many movies are like, this is just, you know, this is what I'm in the mood for. I just want to have some candy,
right,
giggle, and that's enough. But that's somehow, you know, I think that's the really the sad state of affairs on Broadway, is that there's no, you know, range. If you're not Sunday in the Park with George, you're just derided, and I think that's really a shame. But Sunday in the Park with George actually being my favorite musical. I know my stuff. It's not like I'm saying, you know, that I don't appreciate the great words. It's just, you know, it's like something about theater folk. You know, they're a lot. You know, that they want everything to be a masterpiece.
Yeah,
and I understand that, but at the same time, there's, you know, and it's certainly your point of the ticket prices being too high.
And it didn't always used to be like that. That's what's so funny, is that just growing up in New York City, me and my family saw a lot of mediocre musicals.
Yeah.
I won't name any, but...
I actually have to say, my favorite thing, I'm going back a little bit to what I'm saying, it's like, you know, I don't like mediocre, I like really bad. I like excellent, and I like really bad. The stuff in the middle like really holds no interest for me, and that goes for movies too. I was in Washington, and this journalist asked me, "What's your favorite bad movie?" And I was like, "Oh, that's such a good question. I love so many bad movies." And it's a real, I think anything that has energy in its badness, I'm all for.
Or just really, something unexpected.
Really took a chance.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I will say, and I know this hits a little close to home, so I'll tread a little bit carefully, but seeing Joseph, an Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, with Michael Damian, Michael Damian on Christmas Eve, whatever year that was, when he threw up right on stage, it was just enjoyable for the whole audience, I feel.
Was he in the harness with the rainbow coming out of his ass at the moment he threw up?
It wasn't working well for anyone, Abe. It wasn't working well, but it was so bad that it was good. And all my fellow Jews who were there on Christmas.
He got it all over all their Mega Mix whites. It was a disaster. You know, I wasn't in that production, but I can, you know, with it was the same staging, so I can only imagine.
All right, well, then you made this.
In that color. Like, it was the one color that wasn't on his coat yet.
No, well, but he really, it completed it. It completed it for us all. And then at some point there was Doonesbury the musical, and that's enough about that. So then, sir, you made the transition from the wonderful world of Broadway to the world of film.
Mm-hmm.
And short films are a little different than Broadway musicals. What was that adjustment like for you? It's a little bit different scope.
I actually don't feel they're that different.
Go for it. Yeah.
I don't think the film, and you know, it's the same skill set. You just have to learn your lights and your cameras and learn your lenses and know what everybody's job is. But I found when I got to film school, I had a bit of a leg up only because I knew how to stage manage people.
Yeah.
I had experience as a choreographer, and to get, you know, 100 people, you know, coalesced around an idea. I mean, that part is the same. You know, it's people acting, people saying words, people dancing on screen. It's all the same stuff. I mean, definitely, I think, you know, in terms of performance, it comes from a different wellspring of, of emotional inspiration, I guess. I think that's really the one difference. I think that theater folks like to think that, you know, that only they know how to do theater, and film folks that like to think they don't know how to do film. And I think that, you know, there are they're much closer cousins than I think both worlds would like to admit.
And I would imagine, as you mentioned, that your background in choreography has to be particularly useful in getting everyone to move.
Yeah, getting everyone to move, get the camera to move around people. You know, so much of directing is you walk here and the camera's going to pass you there, and you know, thinking, being able to think three-dimensionally is it's the same thing. I actually think that the closer cousin, I think, is editing. In that it is rhythmic and it's dance and it's musical, and if you just don't have a sense of innate timing, your editing's not going to be so hot.
Right. I know, I would imagine.
That's probably the closer cousin between dance and film, choreography and film.
And talk to me about the transition from short films to a feature-length film. I would assume that going from short films to a 90-minute film is about more than just creating something longer.
So much of it's actually just stamina. I mean, the actual physical part of production, is obviously longer and more intense. And but I have to say, because I had such a fantastic crew on my first time out, it was easier than my short films to make. One of the main reasons for that is that I wasn't driving the truck myself.
Right.
You just focus on directing the movie, and I wasn't paying for it myself like I was with my shorts, putting it on my own credit card. I mean, those things are, that seemed to me to be the biggest difference and a real improvement.
Craft services provided by somebody else.
I guess the difference is, it's sort of the difference between, writing a short story and writing a novel.
Mm-hmm.
The shape of them certainly is different. But I think in my shorts, I always tried to have kind of a three-act structure, even within the framework of 3 minutes or 9 minutes or 20 minutes, trying to get a satisfying experience. I didn't do a lot of, sort of experimental filmmaking with my shorts. So things were pretty straightforward. Although I'd always throw in musical numbers. I can't say I wasn't experimental. I certainly have my own way of doing things and my own culture and point of view and sensibility. But the storytelling was pretty straightforward in my short film. So, I think making this feature was a lot easier because like I said, I wasn't actually lighting the scenes myself. I had people to help with that, which was great.
Well, that brings us to Dirty Girl. How many times have you, Abe Sylvia, seen the film Dirty Girl?
Oh, I have no idea at this point. It's like, how many versions of it have I seen? How many, how many times have I seen it? It's it's immeasurable. But I haven't, the interesting thing is I haven't seen it in a while, which is a trip to go back to. And I haven't seen it in a couple months after seeing it probably four times a day for a year and a half. So going back to it might be a really interesting experience.
Well, now, what kind of eye do you have towards seeing it again? Are you the type of director that's going to look at it and say, oh, I kind of wish I had changed that? Or are you, at this point, you're good with where this film is?
I think, I look at my shorts and I still have to see things I'd like to do differently. I never really feel finished with a movie. I think every director, every editor, what they say is at some point you just stop.
Right.
I could tinker with it for forever and throw it up in front of an audience and be like, I can fix the timing of that joke just by a frame. I sort of know my film so well, I'm like, oh, if I just see two frames on that shot. Yeah. But you do have to just sort of make your peace and say that it's what it's going to be forever. And it's a very weird thing to sort of hand off. But I'm very proud of the finished product.
Now, I would assume that Toronto will always have a special place in your heart.
It was. Yeah. Absolutely.
What was the film festival? So now, let's go back a few steps. Before the film even got picked up, what made you submit to that particular film festival? Or do you send it out to a bunch of places? How does that process work?
Well, we really set our sights on Toronto and Sundance.
Okay.
Just because of the timing of when we finished the film. I finished the film, we shot it in April, And the festival, Toronto was in September. So I really wanted to just kind of keep the momentum going.
Mm-hmm.
I really gunned for Toronto, and we finished the film really quickly. so we could make that deadline, and luckily they accepted the film. You know, God, we finished the film on a Thursday, on a Thursday. I bought a suit on a Friday, and on Saturday we were screening it.
Wow!
But I'd never seen it in front of an audience.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, it was a real trip, because I was used to watching the movie by myself, and so to suddenly see it with 600, you know, the film world elite sitting there with their arms crossed, you know, like, what are you going to show us, kid? It was fairly daunting, but, you know, luckily, I walked out at the end of the movie, and my producer said Harvey Weinstein bought it. I'm like, when did that happen? In my head, I'm still mixing the film.
So right.
It was a real head trip. You know, you just kind of, it's kind of out of body. It isn't, you know, it's like a Kander and Ensog quiet thing. You know?
Yes.
It all kind of comes together, and you're like, all right, he's kind of nodding. Like, yeah, it's a quiet thing.
Did you go and see other films after you found that out, or were you like, yeah, I can't really focus right now?
No, I was pretty focused. I just had I didn't see a lot of other films, frankly, because I, you know, had a lot of work to do while I was there. I did see Lance Black's film, because we shared a producer,
mm-hmm.
What's Wrong with Virginia? What's the Matter with Virginia?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I saw that film as well, which I liked quite a bit. And but that was the only other film I saw, sadly.
It was a good festival for you, though.
It was a fantastic festival, and you know, the fact that we made such a nice sale was a real vindication for a lot of hard work. And you know, I was just so happy that my investors, you know, these people who really did take
it, yeah.
You know, I mean, that they all made their money back. I mean, that's...
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, they're whole. And that, yeah, the people who took the biggest risk of all, you know, I felt a real responsibility to them. You know, I'm not one of these directors who treats their producers like an ATM. I realized, like, you just gave me $3 million. I take that responsibility seriously. That's a relatively small budget for a feature film. It's like, I take this really, really seriously.
Yeah.
This is your children, you know, for one of my producers, it was her children's college fund.
Right.
And, So you know, I took it very seriously.
Yeah, no pressure on that one.
Yeah, exactly. That's the part you disconnect from a little bit. You're like, okay, I'm aware that this needs to happen, but if I really took that on, I wouldn't be able to function.
So. Yeah. So now what happens now? What's next?
Well, the Dirty Girl came out.
Yeah.
It's coming out, and it's going to be out on DVD January 17th.
Great.
And I'm really looking forward to that release. It's a little movie, and I think movies like this really find their... You know, there isn't as much of a model for you know, edgy, you know, small comedies.
Absolutely.
You know, there isn't a theatrical model really for them these days. I mean, I think the world is really coming, you know, just like that somehow, sadly enough, you know, movie theaters are really for like big event tentpole.
Yeah.
Big, and it's hard for little movies to kind of elbow their way in there. We're finding it this year. So many great little gems that are, you know, not succeeding at the big houses. But, you know, they'll have lives on DVD, and they'll have lives, you know, they exist. And video on demand is huge. And the way people are, you know, watching movies now is changing.
Yeah.
So, you know, luckily that, you know, all of these movies will be, will have a life, all these wonderful little movies. Yeah. And next for me, I'm working with, I'm working with Claudia Scheer on adapting her play, Dirty Blonde, into a film.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'm sure you're probably familiar with the film.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it was on Broadway, I think, in 2000. It was actually playing down the street from me when I was in the producers, and I remember going on my day off and seeing Dirty Blonde, and it had a real impact on me. And a couple years ago, I reached out to her and said, gosh, you know, I can't believe a movie of that play has never been made. And so I reached out to Claudia. He's like, I can't believe it either. So we've been we've been working on the script, and she's an amazing writer, and very excited about it. I mean, for people who don't know, the play is a biopic about Mae West that's played out against a romantic comedy about two Mae West fans living in present day New York, and how, you know, their idolatry and obsession with movie star gets in their way of real love. And human connection, the way, you know, as much as we love our movies, that's how they screw us up.
Yeah.
So you're giving a center-plated notion about, you know, how our ideas of romantic love are supposed to work out.
Right. And, oh, that sounds great.
Yeah, and it's a new way of doing a romantic comedy, and it's a new way of doing a biopic, basically. And I'm really excited about it. So I'm working on that, and I wrote a pilot for HBO. And so we'll see how that, you know, the TV world is new to me, and we'll see how that all turns out. And I'm collaborating currently with Sandra Bernhardt on filming her one-woman show and, you know, turning it into a concert film. So I'm really excited about that. She's been one of my heroes I've got my whole life, frankly.
Oh, she's fantastic. Now, what do you think Sandra or any of your other actors, and now, see, this is kind of a tough question for you because we've asked other directors this, and we weren't necessarily able to prove the answer because some of your actors are out in the press saying, oh, this is what he's like as a director. What would you say they would say about you as a director? And know that we can verify your answer with them.
Well, you know, it's so funny. We did so many of these press roundtables and stuff. I actually know what their answers are.
That's not fair.
Yeah, sorry. I think they'd say I was gentle and passionate at the same time, and I've been an actor myself, and I think you get the best work from people when they really feel like they can take ownership of their character, and you need to listen to their needs, and you need to make sure their needs are met, and you need to make sure your story is being told at the same time. And those are not, those sometimes can be, you know, mutually exclusive.
Right.
So finding a way, you know, to get the best out of people, you know, and still get what you need, I find gets the best results.
Fantastic. Yeah, that's what they said.
Yeah, I think it you have to have an, for me, I mean, I'm just codependent in that aspect. Like, if I host a party, I want everyone to be having a good time. I want everybody on the crew to be having a good time. I want the actors to feel like they're a part of something special. You know, I am not somebody who, I don't yell, and I don't like people around me yelling, and I think if we're not having fun doing it, what's the point?
And by fun, I mean,
you know, not that it's all and giggles. Oh, excuse my language.
It's okay.
You can edit that out, too. I kind of have a potty mouth.
You've done so well so far.
I've done so well. You know, but, and by fun, I mean, you know, it's like you're getting a group to, you know, shoot 9 pages in a day, and we're stressed out, and we don't know if we're going to get it, and you know, you know, I've never been to war, but I think it's probably a little bit like going to war, except it doesn't have any bullets. So, but a real adrenaline rush, and you know, at the end of the day, everyone's feeling that they've done well with their 24 hours on Earth that day.
Then you feel good about coming back the next day.
You feel good about coming back the next day and meeting the challenges again.
All right, that's what they said about you. They said you were nice. Fine. All right, we do have to talk about your musical selections for this week's show.
This I'm constantly soundtracking. So
this is good. This is a good thing.
I was, you know.
You got very excited about this part that you got to choose the music.
Yes.
Well, this is the part of the show, Abe Silvia, where you tell our listening audience what some of your song selections say about Abe Silvia. It's a little self-analysis. For our listening audience.
Oh, gosh.
I know, this is very exciting.
I thought about them more as why they're my favorites. Maybe the self-analysis will become clear.
I think it's going to become clear. Well, and we'll do all three. So, The Masquerade is Over. What does The Masquerade is Over say about Abe Silvia?
I don't know what it says about me. I'm going to talk on that one. It's my favorite. That particular recording is my favorite recording of any vocalist of all time. And, Nancy Wilson.
So great.
She's certainly in my top five, and this is my favorite thing ever put down in a studio ever. I think the opening phrase is so perfection. She says, "Your eyes don't shine." She says it in such a way that it actually reflects, the lyrics are actually coming through the performance, and her emotionality is, when she says shine, she is shining. You know, it's pretty masterful. I like to think that, you know, Nancy Wilson is the vocal equivalent of, like, a Rilke poem. you know, you always feel like she's speaking directly to you. Yeah. She's whispering in your ear, and it's not overdone, and yet, you know, she's not doing all these vocal gymnastics, but she is communicating the lyric in such a simple and straightforward way that it's so classy and so much more moving than somebody who's involved in all the histrionics.
I think our listening audience is doing the self-analysis for you on that one. That one seems pretty transparent.
I'll say this much about it. You know, I think anybody who's ever fallen in love and fallen out of love with somebody, you know, the song is about that moment where you realize that this is not what it once was. And certainly how sad that is. But she gets that feeling just right of kind of ennui and... you know, and regret, and how do you sort of gather yourself to move on? I mean, I think I am not alone in having that experience.
No, you are not. You are not.
It's fairly universal, but
I'm sure I have no idea what you're talking about.
Right, but I hear that. You know, it's not as much of an analysis as you're probably going to get out of me. on that front, you know, the fact that it's my favorite recording should tell you enough.
There you go. Well, this is a fun transition, because in 3+ years of the show, oddly, we've never played Dusty Springfield's Son of a Preacher Man, a song that I must say... And some people know this about me, used to make me quite a few tips there in the West Village when I was a singing waiter. That was a fun song for me. What does Dusty Springfield, Son of a Preacher Man, say about Abe Sylvia?
Well, that song, it's on a short list of songs that I can... God, that song suits any mood. You can put that song on at any time, and it's one of those ones that everyone will either start dancing or humming along, or if I'm in a bad mood, I'll put it in my, you know, I'll put it on my iPod in my car, and it's like, it's that song always, it just never fails to work.
Right.
It just is not unlike the Nancy Wilson recording. It's perfect recording.
It made me a lot in tips. It's just short enough.
Well, and with Dusty Springfield, again, that's a vocalist, you always know it's her.
Oh, yeah.
It's not overdone, you know, the way so many of these companies, like, you have to be a vocal gymnast to get a recording contract these days, as opposed to having a sound that is completely, you know...
Unique,
sound
yeah.
that is unique is, like, you know, you've got to be able to do, like, backflips on your vocal cords. And it's like, God, there's Dusty Springfield. It's like, oh, I know that's who that is, like, you know. And again, the ability to, like, communicate a lyric. So, you know, both Nancy Wilson and... Dusty Springfield were incredible actresses with their voice. And
yeah.
A slightly lot, which I always think is a much more interesting quality in a singer than, you know, like when you listen to Ella Fitzgerald, you can put all of this onto the performance, all this emotionality in the performance, and you see it and you're like, oh, she's strangely detached. And I always find that to be, you know, an incredible, the restraint that these women show in their live performance. Yeah, pretty masterful. And Son of a Preacher Man, I guess if I was going to get self-analytical, I don't think I ever screwed a boy in the woods who was the Son of a Preacher Man, but would probably have liked to.
This just went from self-analysis to a prospective desire, which is good. We've never done that before.
Well, I mean, there's that. I mean, there's, you know, maybe there is some sublimative transference that I'm doing. I don't know.
Oh, our show is just not that long to get that much into it, especially because you still have one more song, and I would assume that this one holds a lot of emotional value for you because it's from the Dirty Girls soundtrack. Tell us about Whenever I Call You Friend.
Well, it's such a, you know, the movie, for those of you who haven't seen it, is a real homage to Melissa Manchester, who is one of my musical heroes growing up, and the lead gay character in the movie. Is his musical hero, and he, you know, he's able to sort of travel the different worlds through her music and get through another day. I mean, how many gay boys in the 80s didn't turn Don't Cry Out Loud on when they were alone in their room and, you know, make their day go away by listening to Melissa?
I just did it this morning.
There you go. So, you know, when we did this, we used 9 of Melissa's songs in the movie, and I knew for the end credits I wanted to do a cover. So we could show we're bathing the audience in nostalgia with the music. It's like, you know, the music is good because it's timeless. And to show that it's timeless, I'm going to take 2 modern artists and have them put their spin on what is just a great song.
Yeah.
You can say, oh, it's a great song from the 80s. It's just a great song. I mean, Melissa and her music, you know, she's up there with the, you know, these classic Danes that, you know, she had this, you know, pop rock career, but, you know, I think she's a standards singer.
Oh, yeah.
They made, like, Bette Midler is a standard singer. It's like they've had hits along the way, but they belong to that group of women who sing classics and make classics. And whenever Kelly Furniss wrote me a classic, and I was so excited to do this recording because I, you know, again, this is not like Son of a Preacher Man. It's like the song, you can always put it on and it's always good.
I just listened to it before the show. I loved it.
You can listen to the Kenny Loggins Stevie Nicks version, or you can listen to the Melissa Manchester Peabody Bryson version. It's like, it's always really just such a great song. So I took, you know, we matched up Spice Dangerfield from the Guillemots and Anara George, who everybody knows from The Bird and the Bee, who I think is one of the most exciting vocalists we have right now. Again, you know, I guess there's a trend here, you know, an incredible lyrical interpreter. Incredible interpreter of lyrics.
Yeah.
Who shows incredible restraint, and you always know it's her, and it's a definitive voice. And, you know, Fife recorded his vocals in New York City, and then Anara did hers here in L.A., and I got to be in the studio with her, and, you know, she's I just think, is on the cutting edge of what's happening now, and to have her covering one of my favorite singers right in front of me, it was just a very, very cool experience.
Nice. Oh, you did well with that one. See, you got through that segment just fine. You got through it fine.
I can go on and on about music. You know, the stuff analysis part that I, you know, I'll step away from. I'll leave that for another time. I have to pay people to listen to stuff analysis. I haven't actually written you a check, so.
Or you could just get a radio show. I'm telling you, it serves the same purpose.
Where's that?
Well, where can folks go to learn more about all the cool things that you're doing, Abe Sylvia?
I guess they can go to my website, abesylvia.com, although it hasn't been updated in months.
Okay.
But I guess, you know, I'm on Twitter and I'm on Facebook and, you know, all the usual places. And but I really enjoy being here with you.
Well, it's such a treat to have you on the show. You so clearly have just this very unique voice. I love, it's always nice when a director gets it right about what their actors are saying about them, because that's what everyone says about you, is that you have a distinctive voice, that you certainly do have a story to tell, but that you're bringing other people into the mix so that there are as many people as part of the story as possible. And that's really a sign of success and a sign of just great things to come. We're so excited to see more from you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
All right.
I'm excited to see more from you, too.
Well, there you go. We're going to bring the show out on the road and get out there.
Yeah, exactly.
Abe Sylvia, an absolute treat having you on the show. Here's wishing you all the best with future projects.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
Your eyes don't shine. Like they used to shine, and the thrill is gone when your lips meet mine. I'm afraid the masquerade. And so is love. And so is love. Your word.
All right, folks, and we are back. Hi, Jody.
Hi, Ken.
How are you?
I'm well.
So, apologies again for the sound quality of that previous segment. That it happens sometimes. We try some new things.
Mm-hmm.
Someone recommended, hey, you should totally try this piece of equipment. It's going to enhance your show. I did not know that by that they mean it's going to make the sound quality bad.
Yeah, that's not exactly the enhancement you were looking
for. It's not what I was looking for.
No.
So that happened. But Abe Sylvia, amazing guest, and looking forward to more from him. But definitely have that moment as I was pressing play and listening to it again of, God, maybe we should just stop doing the show. because this show sometimes stresses me out. No, we're going to talk through this. It sometimes stresses me out, and I'm going to even pull back the curtain, and I'm going to totally out us right now. This is our second time recording this particular segment. We did this great segment, and then it just kind of went away because it sounded like we were underwater, and we have higher standards than that.
It's true.
But there are people who listen to the show, and they enjoy it, and we do ultimately enjoy doing the show.
Yeah.
And we're gay. I'm gay. I speak from the eye. Sorry.
Yes.
I am gay.
I am as well.
Well, this was a nice moment for us both then. All right. So there... That's important. It's very, very important. Okay, so there is quite a bit of news, and we don't have a lot of time left in the show because I talked to Abe for so long, but there's quite a bit of gay news to get out there into the world, and the biggest of them all is what just happened with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who made a huge, huge announcement yesterday in a historic address before the United Nations in Geneva. Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton called on all countries to respect the civil rights of LGBT individuals. The secretary also announced a new U.S. initiative to support organizations working to protect gay people who are marginalized and targeted with violence. Her speech followed a memorandum issued yesterday morning, Tuesday morning, by President Obama, who, in a multifaceted strategy, directed federal agencies engaged abroad to defend LGBT rights. This is a huge, huge deal. I'll read a quote from Secretary of State Clinton, but you should go online because you can watch the entire speech. You can watch it online. The internet, I don't know if you know this, internet totally has videos. You can watch videos on the internet.
Really?
Yeah, not just for words.
Wow.
Not just for words. Moving images with people talking.
Huh.
Pretty cool. She said, quote, "Today I want to talk about the work we have left to do to protect one group of people whose human rights are still denied in too many parts of the world today. In many ways, they are an invisible minority. They are arrested, beaten, terrorized, even executed. Many are treated with contempt and violence by their fellow citizens, while authorities empowered to protect them look the other way or too often even join in the abuse. I am talking about gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people, human beings born free and given bestowed equality and dignity, who have a right to claim that, which is now one of the remaining human rights challenges of our times."
Wow.
It's good stuff. It's good stuff.
It's
now,
very...
I will tell you, one of the reasons that I love everything that she said, I don't think I have this quote right in front of me. I do not have the quote right in front of me, but she acknowledges that here in the U.S., it's not like we're great.
Like we're doing a
yeah,
whole lot
not,
better.
We're not doing this fantastically well, and we're not the role model for all the other countries.
Right.
But I love that she acknowledges that we have a lot more to do here, but that there's so much more to do abroad. And so in President Obama's memo, he outlined, here are some of the strategies they're looking at: combat the criminalization of LGBT status or conduct abroad, ensure swift and meaningful U.S. responses to human rights abuses of LGBT persons abroad.
Wow.
Now, that's very interesting.
Hmm.
Ensure swift and meaningful U.S. responses to human rights abuses of LGBT persons abroad. Now, I may have been watching too much West Wing, but that to me means even the far end of we might send in a troop.
Or something. Yeah.
Huh. Unsurprisingly, Republican candidates for the presidential nomination, not thrilled with any of this. Not thrilled with any of this.
Mm.
And in particular, Mr. Perry and Mr. Santorum. Perry, Rick Perry.
Yes, I figured. Yes.
Rick Perry. Not Katy Perry.
No.
Katy Perry loves it.
She, yeah. Yeah. I'll bet.
Not Perry White, because that was Superman's editor.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, you got it.
That's important. And I think he was gay.
He might have been.
I don't think he was. So Perry issued a statement on his campaign's website denouncing the landmark program. And he said, where are some fun quotes from Rick Perry? He said, quote, "Just when you thought Barack Obama couldn't get any more out of touch with America's values, AP reports his administration wants to make foreign aid decisions based on gay rights." He said the Obama administration is making war on traditional American values and on people of faith by promoting a lifestyle they find deeply objectionable. If he were president, Jody, and you were just saying to me before, hey, what would happen if Rick Perry were president?
Right.
And I will answer that. If he were president, he would, quote, consider aid requests based solely on America's national security interests. Promoting special rights for gays in foreign countries is not America's interest and not worth a dime of taxpayers' money.
You know,
they're sitting on an oil well.
The thing that really gets me about that is, I mean, everything about it is crap. But the biggest thing that I really take issue with is he says very broadly, people of faith have a problem with this.
Right.
And that is not, you cannot say that unilaterally. You cannot say that because there are plenty of people of faith who have no problem and in fact support everything that Hillary is saying in this proclamation.
Yeah.
And so I absolutely oppose him representing all people of faith, saying people of faith generally, as a rule, oppose this.
Yeah. Speaking of, we should give a shout out right now to the Reverend, and you have to say
the Reverend.
The Reverend, yes. Emily C. Heath, who's been on the show a few times before. Did you hear what happened with the Reverend?
No.
So Emily writes pieces for Bellerico.
Oh, yes.
.com. Yep. Mm-hmm. And is that how you say that? I never know.
I actually have never heard it pronounced, so I just...
We just read it.
Yeah.
So she writes pieces for that website, which has a ton of different authors, many of whom we've had on the show.
Mm.
And someone wrote a piece that said in every single... in every single hotel room, there is a user manual on how to kill people. And he was talking about the Bible.
Oh.
And so she wrote a letter and just said, that's it. I'm done writing for this website.
Yeah.
This is, you're lumping in all faiths together. You are saying this is what faith is. And so she is not writing for them anymore.
Oh,
and
that's terrible.
Isn't that terrible? That's terrible that she's not writing for them anymore.
That is terrible. And like all around that's terrible.
So that was going on. And then with other presidential candidates, I'm always kind of curious what the threshold is for them to say, hey, I'm not going to run anymore. Because Michelle Bachmann, she can't possibly think, just based on the polls, and we're not a politics show. We talk about politics, but we're not. I do not have a background in politics in order to be able to predict whether or not Michelle Bachmann's going to make a comeback. That said, she's not going to make a comeback, so I don't really understand. I mean, I feel pretty confident in my PhD in education to say. And I mean, I was an aide to Senator Leahy for, I mean, I wasn't at all, but I work for someone who was, so therefore I can predict trends, and she's not making a comeback. One person who is not voting for her, and this is for two reasons.
Yeah.
There is an 8-year-old boy who is not going to be voting for her for two reasons. Mm-hmm. One, because he can't vote yet.
Right.
And that's, it's one of the laws, Jody.
It is.
It's a law.
Yep.
So the other reason is she was at a book signing. And he went up to her and he said something, but she couldn't really hear him. And she was being very parental. And so she grabbed him by the shoulders in this kind of creepy way and pulled him towards her. She was on one side of the table. He was on the other. And he whispered to her, quote, my mom is gay and she doesn't need fixing. And the boy, identified only as Elijah, you can watch this on YouTube. And Michelle Bachmann had a response.
Yeah. I'll bet. What?
She had, and I'm not sure if I've told you this before, she had this really textured, multi-layered, you can just look at it in so many different ways, and we don't have a ton of time to deconstruct it, but let's make an attempt.
Okay.
This really, it's from this handbook on how to respond to 8-year-olds who are talking about their gay moms, which I think we have that here. It's in our library. We can check it out after this.
Mm-hmm.
So she looked him in the eyes, and eye contact is important.
Oh, yes.
And by the way, she totally did not look him in the eyes. She just looked away. And she said, quote, and let me read this because I don't want to miss anything.
Yeah.
Quote, okay, bye-bye. End quote. I didn't want to leave that dangling because I didn't want someone to think, oh, there's more. So, I mean, obviously, there's a lot that she's saying. She's referencing, she is referencing the Magna Carta. That's very clear that she's talking about the Magna Carta. Mm. Something about Coretta Scott King, I'm not exactly sure what, but I heard that there was some connection there.
Do you hear any Gandhi in there?
There's a little, she was standing.
Okay.
And there was food on the table.
Oh, so maybe not.
So I didn't think it was, but I can see how I could see how you would say that.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the Boston Tea Party thing is just a little obvious, so I don't even want to reference that.
Right.
And then oddly, it's got that whole Princess Leia thing to it, and I'm not sure how that works.
I don't either.
Yeah, but she's obviously kind of referencing Princess Leia, so it's really it's textured. it's textured. I mean, yeah. She might as well have lifted it straight out of Beetlejuice. So, again, it's really, it's got a lot of different, you know, she's got a lot to say.
Yes, apparently.
She's got a lot mm-hmm. to say.
Many words.
And so, my mom is gay and she doesn't need fixing. This boy didn't deserve that. He didn't deserve her acrimonious, okay, bye-bye.
And
no. That's a little over his head. I think it's a little over his head. It's not been a good week for her. It has not been a good week for
her. When has it been a good week for
her? Oh, I, you know, as a political pundit, I will say that when, because I do follow this somewhat, I actually do follow this somewhat, the first debate, she did very well.
Oh?
Unfortunately, they've had 23 other debates
uh-huh.
since then. Do
right.
you hear who's moderating one of the,
no.
I think it's the Iowa debate?
No.
Donald Trump.
Huh.
Yeah.
Maybe he'll fire her.
That would be great.
Yeah.
That would be great.
Yeah.
Now, she was confronted by a high school student at an event in Iowa last week, and you can watch this on the YouTube as well. It's gone viral. 16-year-old Jane Schmidt asked Bachman, quote, why can't same-sex couples get married? Now, this was before the whole okay, bye-bye. So this
oh.
was before her people told her, look, you really need to have more textured responses.
I see. The
so
precursor.
She, yeah. So she mm-hmm. said, quote, they can get married. I think that's where you say can added emphasis. I'm just saying that. Mm. They can get married if they abide by the same laws as everyone else. They can marry a man if they're a woman. They can marry a woman if they're a man. That is the wonderful world of Michelle Bachman, to which Jody and I will now say, okay,
bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Personally, I think the more that young people start confronting these...
Care-fronting.
Care-fronting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, is that yours or is that coined elsewhere?
No, it's a care-frontation.
A care-frontation.
Yes.
Okay. The more that young people do that, the more we're going to be able to get rid of these people. Because that when they say dumb stuff like that in front of young people... they really look dumb.
Yeah.
They look way more dumb than they do saying it to adults.
I think she lost his vote, that 8-year-old.
I think she probably lost.
Yeah.
Way more votes.
Yeah. So, if you want more political pundit advice, just write to us. All right, a couple other stories. Which directions do I want to go right now? We could talk a little bit about porn. Gay teacher with a background in porn, you're for it?
I think as long as it doesn't interfere with his ability to teach.
There's a whole story over on Advocate. It's an op-ed by porn actor Connor Habib, and he's also a teacher, and he's got a whole article about an op-ed about a teacher who got fired, Kevin Hogan, who was recently suspended from his teaching job at Massachusetts Mystic Valley Regional Charter School for his gay porn past. He's got some things to say about that. I love this first paragraph, though. Whenever a porn hopeful asks me for advice about... and this is, by the way, Connor, not me, because porn hopefuls often don't ask me for advice. But if you want to ask me for advice, just drop me an email, ken@thisshowisogay.com, and I will give you advice. Whenever a porn hopeful asks me for advice about getting into, quote, the industry, and it is surely an industry, a workplace,
oh, yeah.
I often respond, quote, make sure you can tell everyone about it. Otherwise, don't do it.
Mm.
I thought that was pretty... sound advice.
I think it's very wise.
Very wise.
Yeah.
Very wise. I don't know. There's all these other stories out there that we don't really have a lot of time to get to. Michigan students, they will now get to sing about their gay apparel.
I'm so relieved.
For a little bit there, they weren't.
Which is silly.
At the Cherry Knoll Elementary School, they were singing Deck the Halls, and the teacher changed it to Dom, We Now Are Bright apparel.
Not the same thing.
Not... the same thing.
No.
And then the teacher who I think was had some arthritic issues, he put on some Ben Bright. I'll give you a second to get that one. It's like Ben
Jenner. Oh, okay.
God. And then in Macy's, there's a worker who was fired in Macy's in San Antonio because he wouldn't let a trans woman use a woman's room. A woman's fitting room, so that's all going on, and you can read about that, and the Liberty Council is taking that up. It's silly. We're not even going to get into that. We don't even have time. This was a jam-packed show. We don't have time, really, for anything else. So, we will tell people that there are so many different ways you can get in touch with us.
Mm.
You should, of course, email us. You can send an email to us at ken@thisshowisogay.com. or Jody at thisshowisogay.com. You can go to thisshowisogay.com to learn all about the really fun things that are happening with the show. We seem to be adding new and amazing guests every other second, so you should go check that out, including next week, comedian, actress, author, I'm almost done with her book, I enjoy it immensely, Jerry Jewell. You probably remember her from The Facts of Life, although she's on a show that I don't watch, Deadwood, on HBO, which a lot of people watch it, and she's been on a lot of episodes of Deadwood, so you should go check that out. And of course, go to the Facebook, type in The Show Is So Gay, like us, we like you, and people are writing these really great things there on the Facebook page, and we would love to hear from you as well. Got a really nice comment from Christopher in New Jersey, who's got a commute, he's got an hour-long commute, and he listens to us, so shout out to you, Christopher, this one is for you. We really gotta go. We gotta go.
Okay.
We got other stuff to do. So get out there, folks. Go do some amazing, amazing things. If you've got a gay radio show, keep going. Don't let your technical issues get you down.
That's
Come
right.
back the next week. And while you're doing it, remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?